Blog Talk Radio.
Alrighty there, folks. This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Hey, yo, it's the Tornado, Tony Pinnacle.
And we have a nice guest-free Fight News Unlimited talk show tonight. Sports combat sports show, I should say. I couldn't get a guest this week, but we're working on next week for sure.
If you want, I'll talk in multiple personalities.
You can do that. But I'm sure Tom will be on here momentarily. I was actually trying to work on getting Arash Usmani, but I never got any response from his PR people. I don't know. I think he might. I don't know if he speaks English fluently, but.
That would make it kind of hard now, wouldn't it?
Yeah, he might need a translator if that's the case. But I think he's been in the United States for a while. I think it's Rance's Barthelemy, his last opponent, that has the language barrier. But I figured I'd give it a shot anyway. I just didn't hear anything back from those people. But we got enough news to talk about, that's for sure. You mentioned Rocky VII. Why don't you break the news on that?
Well, and I'm going to actually have to talk to Tom about this, too, when he gets on the air. I know he's Tom
just
chomping at the
bit. Tom just clicked.
Oh, Tom, you there?
I'm on. Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Rocky 7, huh?
It's official. I'm going out for the movies again.
Oh, okay.
Did you guys hear about this?
No.
Not a word.
Well, it's not definite yet, but I know they're kicking around a script right now, and it sounds awful. Let's be totally honest. I mean, they surprised me with the last one, Rocky Balboa. I mean, at first when I first talked about it, and I remember Sylvester Stallone even mentioned it on The Contender that year, which was about 6 months, was aired about 6 months before they were doing the auditions. So he may have been writing a script and he was keeping it secret. But I remember one of the fighters asking him, are you going to do Rocky VI? He's like, what am I going to be fighting, arthritis? And that was a joke about it. Well, he came out, like, first I was skeptical as hell. But then as it got closer, I'm like, I'm auditioning for this thing. And I auditioned. I was on the set a few days. My feet got cut out, but, you know, I was still there. You know, they can never take that away from me. And it turned out what I didn't like about Rocky Balboa, the movie, was I thought the second half was a little too rushed. It was like, in the beginning, I think they could have added about another, at least 15 minutes to it. It was almost like the second half happened way too fast. It was like in the beginning, you know, he's lonely and he's, you know, trying to cope with life as a widower and reliving his past glory and, you know, things aren't the way they used to be. He doesn't have a good relationship with his son and this and that and this and that. And then finally he gets to fight again. And then next thing you know, it's like Carver's promoters are like, hey, you want to fight the champ? Oh, no, not really. I don't want to get beat up. No, that'll never happen. It'll be an exhibition. Okay. And then they're having a press conference. Then they train for 3 minutes and it's the fight time. You know, shouldn't it be at least a little bit more, like, it was a little bit from the very second he started training, he was like his 35-year-old self. You know, like he hadn't missed a beat.
He has to be like three hormones.
The basis for this one, apparently, it's going to be called Creed. And as we all know, they killed off Apollo in Rocky IV, so it can't be about him. But it's apparently supposed to be about his grandson. And his grandson comes from a rich family because of all the money Apollo made during the years and all that. Maybe, I don't know if there's going to be a lawsuit or whatever with the Drago fight. They got more money. Who knows? But he's got all this money, but he wants to start boxing because he's got, you know, the family lineage. And the family's against it, so he seeks out Rocky to train him.
So the grand...
Yeah. It's going to be called Creed. And apparently Rocky's going to be like a secondary character.
Yeah.
Now, if they do have any scenes in Philly, fuck it, I'm going for it.
Nice.
Okay, now what role are you applying? What are you going to try to get?
Just to see as an extra. When I went down to the audition the last time, it was basically an open cattle call. And they knew that the fact that it was a Rocky movie was going to really resonate a lot of passion in the Philadelphia fan base. So the way they did it was they broke the audition times up. They had like 2 or 3 hours for the professional actors with real resumes, then 2 or 3 hours for schmucks like me. I don't know how big the line was for the professionals, but when I went down there, it was a cattle call. And what they were doing was, this was by a company called Heary Casting, and I got to meet Diane Heary, who runs it, that day. You know, they're asking people, like, you'd literally fill out an application when you went down there, like your name, your address, if you had any experience, which the people I'm in the line with had no, and then, like, a headshot. Well, I didn't have a headshot, you know. The only headshot I ever got was, you know, when the guy would punch me inside the head, like guys like Brian Kyron, Frank Stoltz. So what I ended up doing was just taking a boxing photo, me and my robe and everything, with a pair of gloves on. And that's what I used. And I was actually standing in line with a guy named Tim Scott from Penn State, who was the 1998 national champion at 195 pounds. And I fought him in his first amateur fight. And so me and he and I hung out in line together, and a lot of people, like, they were just taking your applications, looking at your headshot, and just filing them, like, they were just, like, collecting them, really. But then every so often, they'd ask people to go up, and they'd say, hey, do you want to read for a part? Yeah, sure, what do you think? And with me, it was like a white trash thug in a bar. And I'm like, sure, I'll read for it. You know, and they're like, come on, act like you're a little pissed off, you're a little angry. This guy thinks he's better than you. You know, you're in a bar. Who's this guy looking at you? Was he looking down on you? So they were just trying to piss you off so you would really get into the part. But I just went down there thinking, hey, I'm a boxing guy. Maybe they need people in the gym just to be in the background and punch the heavy bags. That's what I originally went there for.
Uh-huh. Well, hey, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained, buddy. No guts, no glory.
Exactly.
What's that, right? No risk, no reward.
Right.
All right.
Going back to Tom's favorite place next week, that being the casino.
Uh-huh.
Trying to run my streak of good luck to another adventure.
Well, you mentioned Rocky. It's Sylvester Stallone is pretty much the main character in all those movies. And now he's going to be co-starring with Ronda Rousey. Big news out this week that Rousey got another movie role. She's going to be, I haven't heard anything recently, but I know that she's signed to be in the next Hunger Games sequels. There's going to be two of them. But,
before I forget, do you know who they're auditioning or there's rumored to play the part of Apollo Creed's grandson?
Who?
A name that both you and I know very well.
Hank Bundy.
Who'd you say?
Hank Bundy.
Yeah.
Really?
But no, the name of a guy named Michael B. Jordan or Michael P. Jordan. I'm like, I wonder if it's Mike Jordan from Army.
Really?
He's an actor. His name's like Michael something Jordan. I think he was on some type of TV show or some type of movie. Obviously, it's not the same Michael Jordan as the basketball player, and likely not the same Michael Jordan that we both fought in '98.
Right, that's funny. Well, so then The Expendables 3 with Ronda Rousey. That's the news from this week. Apparently, it doesn't look like Randy Couture is going to join him. But he was in, I think, the first one. I don't know about number two. I didn't see number two. But anyway, you know, it's a lot of talk, of course, of whether this is going to be a repeat of the Gina Carano situation. Because, you know, once she got into the movie, she never went back to MMA. And Rhonda hasn't really been on the screen yet. I think she has done some filming. She obviously did some TV filming, too, for the Ultimate Fighter, but I wonder what will happen once she does get on the big screen and people start seeing her and start thinking about casting her in their own films. Might entice her to walk away from getting punched in the face for real so that she can get punched in the face fake. for viewer enjoyment, basically, I guess. Anyway, also on the movie, as we said, Stallone, Bruce Willis will be back, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Steven Seagal and Mickey Rourke.
Wow.
So,
a
lot of people. A lot of ass kickers in that one.
Yes.
They ought to have Judo Jean LaBelle in there so he can choke out Seagal again. another Curtis 50 Cent Jackson show coming up pretty soon. Actually, it's tonight. Tonight's July 24th, right?
25th.
Missed it?
Oh, it was last night. Sorry. I just got the news today. But I guess last night, I don't know what the results were, but he promoted with Lou DiBella, which is for him, I think, down in New York. But Yuri Foreman was the main event against Jamal Davis. Yuri is 30-2, or maybe 31-2 by now. And
I don't know Jamal personally, but I know some people that trained with him in Philadelphia. He's a good guy. I've never had the opportunity to speak with him, but he's done a lot of dedications for breast cancer. I don't remember if his wife is a survivor or if he lost her to breast cancer, but he's really made that a focal point of his career.
Mm-hmm. Other news we have here. Well, let's talk about Friday Night Fights first, because we just mentioned Hank Lundy, and what a hell of a job he did there in the main event.
Yes.
Rudy Foreman did beat Jamal Davis by unanimous decision, 80-72 on all three cards.
Wow. Sounds like a basketball score.
Yeah, it does.
That's pretty impressive. But not as impressive as Hank, actually. He won almost every round on one card, and I think there was only two rounds that was the difference in the other two cards in the main event there on Friday. And
it was impressive. What kind of ruined the fight for me, and this is nobody's fault except for ESPN, because they're a bunch of schmucks sometimes. One of my big complaints about ESPN's Friday night fights is it's never, and I forget who we talked to, one of our guests, we actually discussed this point a few weeks ago. It's never consistent with it. You know, you have the period from like September to January where there's the biggest question about hockey, college basketball, college football. So we pretty much put boxing on the shelf for 4 months. Then by the time January rolls around, it takes you about a week or two to really get back in a viewing pattern. Now, the other problem is they're always inconsistent with the times. Is it going to be 9 o'clock, 9:30, 10 o'clock, 10:30, 11 o'clock? You know, so you never can sit there and say, okay, it's Friday night, 9 o'clock, I'm going to stand and watch the fights. And then they always run whatever's airing first can be late. I remember college basketball games that went to 4 overtimes. Fights are running late. And you get pissed off. Soccer games that run late, tennis matches. Only things that don't run late is when they show like 1 hour, like pre-recorded shows. You know that's going to be on time. So this fight last week happened to be preceded by a soccer match. I'm not a big soccer fan, never have been, probably never will be, but hey, I can appreciate it. It's a worldwide phenomenon. So here's the problem. The fight's going to start at 10:30, but I'm tired, but I banged a couple cups of coffee, so I have my caffeine kicked in, so I'll be up. And I'm sitting on Facebook waiting, you know, just putzing around, waiting for the fights to start. And a kid I know from Philly grows a status out there. Way to go, Hank. Way to kick that guy's ass. I said, what are you reading? What, do you got a crystal ball? He goes, no. He goes, I watched a live stream online. Oh, shit. Well, now I know the results. So I was talking to my dad, and my dad was like, man, this kid's tough. He took Lucas Matisse 10 rounds. Well, I don't know if Hank's going to be able to beat him. A lot of guys were down, Hank. And I'm like, Dad, I'll bet you breakfast on it. You're on. Well, I knew the result. You know, I mean, I confess that it was over. But, he stayed disciplined, and he really used his skills. He didn't try to showboat. He didn't try to do any, you know, dumb, you know, Floyd Mayweather imitations. Kept his defense good, and he boxed a smart fight. And that's why he was able to beat a fighter, a Joe Zay, who was very tough, very strong, very durable, and very dangerous.
And he didn't fade either. You know, he didn't fade out as we got into the later rounds. I was wondering about that.
Right.
But, boy, he's kept his foot on the accelerator.
I was a little worried about him in the early rounds because the other guy was pretty fast. But once I realized that he wasn't getting hurt by anything, and then I saw how he was kind of planning it out, and he's got such a weird defense. I mean, it's like it's a little Floyd in there. There's a little shoulder roll. There's a little bit of George Foreman and Archie Moore with the arms crossed. And there's just a little bit of traditional defense with always one hand up by the chin sometimes. And it's the best combination for him because, especially with this, you know, the way he worked for this fight, he was talking about how hard he worked and, you know, how many hours in the gym he put in to this one, sparring. And he just seemed to have so much more power. It was like everything that he hit Jose flush with, he hurt him. And it got to the point where it seemed like if he had got him hurt a little earlier in one of the rounds, he could have knocked him out. But he wasn't at all pushing himself to get that knockout. And I don't think it would have played into his style to do that either. Because this guy obviously had a pretty hard head. I mean, he was stumbling and bumbling around the ring a couple times and managed to get his wits about him and clinch and do some... I think Hank just kind of wanted to put on a show and just do what he does best, which is, you know, strategize and basically pick the guy apart. And he definitely did that. It was very impressive for a guy who lost two fights in a row. He looked really good. So definitely looking forward to what they do next for him. I thought that was going to be a tough fight for him in the beginning, and then it just kind of got to the point where he was coasting along. It looked pretty good. Yeah. Well, he looked tougher in the first couple of rounds because he had pretty amazing speed, but then, you know, they're both southpaws. They both have a similar defensive style, but I think Jose put his head out there a little bit more and wasn't as smart with his defense. And it seemed like every time he was going forward, he telegraphed something and then ended up going back into the ropes because Hank would hit him with something hard. And he clowned a little bit, too. He did a little Anderson Silva routine in the early round, so that didn't help him. Anyway, MMA news. We've got a couple signings we got to talk about. The big guys, 185. Well, I guess one more fight at 205, and then the rest at 185. Chael Sonnen has signed with the UFC, I think, for a 5-fight contract. I'm not sure the exact number. I'll get to it. But the other signing is pretty unexpected. 9-5 for Roy Nelson.
That was a surprise.
I never thought it would go that long. He said he's going to finish his career in the UFC, and he's going to take about 5 years to do these 9 fights. And, of course, the first one's going to be against Daniel Cormier, which is really what got him the contract in the first place, I think. It's because that's who Daniel Cormier wanted, and the UFC wasn't going to get rid of Daniel Cormier. And I don't think he's anywhere near ready going down to 205 to fight John Jones. So they're going to give him Roy Nelson first. And they've been beefing on Twitter. And now they're actually going to fight. And I would think that Daniel Cormier might have the advantage in that one. But I don't think Daniel Cormier has really been tested yet either. I mean, they threw him a bone with Frank Mir. And Roy Nelson's no Frank Mir. So it'll be a good fight. We'll see. It's going to happen at UFC 166 in Houston. And it's been all confirmed. And that's headlined by another heavyweight title, or another heavyweight fight. It's a title fight between Cain Velasquez and Junior Dos Santos, another rematch. But they've wrapped him up for 9 fights. That's pretty impressive. And I'm just wondering what he had to agree to sign with them for that long. And maybe we won't hear be as critical as he has been in the past of your whole organization. We'll see. We lost a big-time boxer this week, 75 years old, Emil Griffith.
Yeah.
That was a pretty intriguing story. I heard the name, but I wasn't really very familiar with the story until I started reading about all these. He had pugilistic dementia, and he actually is probably most famous for putting a guy in a coma who later died, and had a lot of flack for it. But he was a pretty good fighter with a quick jab, and his career was overshadowed by the fatal beating he gave to Benny the Kid Perret in a 1962 title bout.
You know, that they had a thing on ESPN last night about that. So they had a special on there. If it comes back on, it would be worth you guys catching.
Yeah, I was surprised. I mean, this guy's got a lot of history for crazy stuff. He's also, you know, had a questionable sexuality. They didn't know whether he was bisexual or gay or whatever. But
allegedly what caused the bad blood.
I suppose the guy said something to him at the weigh-in. It was a homosexual slur or something like that. So, he felt like he was going to pay him back in the fight. And Sports Illustrated put that out in 2005, that might have been what fueled his fire there.
Yeah,
but
I think
then
it,
after
was,
that,
it was, yeah, exactly.
If you go back and look at it and look at the final moments of that fight, what you'll often notice is, fatalities happen, but a lot of times what we'll see is a fighter takes a prolonged beating, and then, comes afterwards. The Ray Mancini Duke Kim fight, which I just read about a few months ago, they said actually, as grueling as a fight that was the result of one punch in the 14th round. Because they said nobody with the amount of blood on Kim's brain could have possibly fought as hard as he did in the 13th. Another situation, I always remember the Gabe Ruelas Jimmy Garcia fight, where Ruelas doled out a tremendous beating over like 10 or 11 one-sided rounds before they finally stopped it. Other fights, it's a big punch that, would put a fighter down, out, and, cause damage like that. But the Emil Griffith-Benny Kid Perret fight, this is one where Griffith basically was hammering him after Perret was already defenseless. He was actually hanging through the middle ropes, and Griffith was leaning over the top of him, continuing to hit him. I think the referee's name was Stanley Goldson, I believe. And he was a very competent referee, and that really, caused him tremendous grief.
It was Ruby Gold.
But that was one. You can tell that the anger in Emil Griffith really came through and caused him almost to violently and savagely beat Benny Kid Perret. And I think that's why that gets more notoriety than any of the other fights that I was just talking about. Even Mancini Duku Kim.
Ruby Goldstein
was
the referee. He never worked another fight.
Well, Rudy, in his defense, when he was questioned about that, in the round before that, Griffiths was knocked down, and he was in a bit of trouble in that fight. And it does seem like the culture back then was let it go a little longer than they do today. So, it's kind of hard to second guess him, but it's the way it was back then. And then I remember it was, I think, a year after that, there was a featherweight named Davey Moore, and he died in a fight out in California. And then we got this whole chorus of we've got to ban this barbaric spectacle, and that's that. It was big. I will never remember this stuff when it happened, and it was just all kinds of news about, you know, just all these politicians screaming, we got to do something about it. But all that died down. But yeah, they were really, some of them were introducing some bills to get the sport outlawed.
Yeah, this article says NBC actually halted its live boxing broadcast after the fight, and then the governor at the time of New York, Nelson Rockefeller, actually created a commission to investigate the bout in the whole sport.
Mm-hmm. And then Pat Brown, the governor of California, he was pretty big on that at that time, too. But boxing survived.
Right. So he'll be missed. Griffith was still attending the fight up until a few months ago, I think. So he's definitely well-known in the sport. And he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1990 with a record of 85 wins, 24 losses, 2 draws, and 23 knockouts. And he trained a bunch of fighters, too, including somebody who beat my trainer, Wilfred Benitez, and Juan Laporte, among the most popular ones. So, funeral arrangements are pending, according to this.
Well, Griffith was trained by Gil Clancy, so he had some pretty good lineage for a trainer, that's for sure. And in this special last night on ESPN, Jimmy Breslin was, he was a real critic of boxing, and he was saying that Gil Clancy had instructed Griffith to go out and kill him. And Clancy really, really disputed that. A lot of, you know, interesting allegation, you know.
Right. Yeah. After the fact, that sounds a lot worse than it would if the guy didn't die.
Yeah, because Clancy was adamant. He says, I never would say, use those words to a fighter, ever.
Right. Well, I'll get back to Chael Sonnen here. I do want to mention he's been approved for TRT again for his fight with Mauricio Hua in the main event of UFC Fight Night 26 in Boston, August 17th. And, you know, it's no stranger to him, the whole process, but I don't know if it's been approved before in Massachusetts. I know Massachusetts is fairly new to the fight game as far as mixed martial arts regulation. They've had it, they've had pro MMA around for a lot of years, but just not regulated. Now that it's regulated, I don't know if this is the first case or not, but it wouldn't surprise me if it is. But the UFC president, Dana White, there did say he's going to test the shit out of anybody that is doing TRT. So I imagine that he's going to be going through that kind of stringent testing from the organization itself, in addition to whatever tests they do in Massachusetts.
You know, after such a one-sided beating from John Jones, I apparently the UFC feels that Sonnen still has some market value, that he still has a lot of people that will show up just to see him get shut up or cheer him on, whatever. But, I was kind of scratching my head about that. It was 5 fights, right? A 5-fight contract?
I think so, yeah.
So I guess he's now an official gatekeeper at the 205 division. I think he's going to stay at 205. Well, we'll see, I guess.
He's going to stay just for this one fight, and then he's going to go back down to
185. Okay.
Which is probably going to require a lot of TRT.
Yeah.
To cut down to that weight. But, Hua, I don't know whether he's going to have a legitimate chance to beat Hua, but I think that was just a situation where they needed an opponent quick, and he signed up to do it. So he's like one of those go-to guys. I think that's what Dana White likes more than anything about Sonnen, is that if there's a fight and, you know, they need a guy to step in on a moment's notice, then he's usually there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of times they had to say thanks, but no thanks. But, you know, in this situation, I think who was a little bit closer to his talent level, maybe even above his talent level, I think who had a great shot at winning, but you never know. I mean, Sonnen has obviously put together some good performances before. And he's one of those people that sells his own fights, too, because of his attitude and his WWE mentality, language, and his comedy. He's actually been referenced by some experts and media out there as, like, one guy in MMA who promotes fights like a boxer. And, you know, they want more people to kind of be as spirited as he is, maybe not as disrespectful in some senses, but... The article I read about his contract extension, there's two guys that he wants to fight, and they're both Brazilian. Big surprise. Wanderlei Silva was one of them. I forget who the other guy is. Vitor Belfort. He wants both of those guys. So, if he goes back down to 185, then he either or could be a challenger there. But we'll see. And Vitor is another guy who does TRT, so it could be a battle of the TRT fighters. I don't think he'll be in Brazil, so I don't think Sonnen's allowed in Brazil.
No, I don't think that would work out too well.
No. They'd have to pay a hefty death benefit.
Yeah.
He wouldn't even make it to the ring before he'd get killed. Another big controversy in boxing. Derek Chisora had a fight with Malik Scott, who was previously unbeaten with a 35-0-1 record, 12 knockouts. And last Saturday night at the Wembley Arena in London, Chisora pressed the action, but both fighters had their moments in round one. Scott had a swelling under his right eye and some swelling under his right eye after round one. There was lots of clinching, and Scott seemed to be figuring Chisora out in round two, but Chisora landed some good body shots in round four. In round six, Chisora started bullying Scott into the ropes, and then Chisora suddenly floored Scott with a right hand. Scott didn't seem majorly hurt, but he watched referee Phil Edwards count to nine, and it was ruled that he got up too late. And the time of the knockout was 2:56 of the round, so 4 seconds left in the round. He's standing up at the eight count, and the referee didn't even say the number 10. He got to nine and just waved the fight off with the guy standing up, looking right at him. So it was kind of strange. I don't know whether to say it was a bad call or a good call, but definitely very suspicious the way it was called off with 4 seconds left in the round. Guy looking right at him. But fight stands as it is, as we know. They don't really change stuff like this. They don't review it. And it kind of reminded me of the Mike Tyson versus Buster Douglas fight where they had a long count for Buster Douglas when he got knocked down before he actually got knocked up. But this one was just first time there was a knockdown, and they counted him out.
Yeah, I'm just actually watching it on YouTube right now, and it wasn't even like it was really that clean of a knockdown. Okay, let's go back here. You know, Chisora's bullying him. He lands a right hand, buckles his knees. Okay, he landed a good right hand on the ropes, and then Scott went down to the knee. He's looking at his corner now. He's looking at the referee. 7, 8. Okay. He gets up right at the count of 9, and the referee was calling like it was a 9 count instead of a 10 count. He's like, 8, 9, you're out.
Right.
It's supposed to be 8, 9, 10, you're out. Because Scott was getting up, and you're right. You don't know how hard he was. From what I read, Chisora was, starting to, put a lot of pressure on him. But that was a fight that definitely, was poor officiating. I'm looking at. Now this is only a matter of seconds.
I'm surprised. No, the guy really isn't hurt. You'd think he would protest.
gesture to the referee. Like, he looked at the referee as he's walking over to shake Kisura's hand, and he looked at the referee, and he, like, hit his, like, pounded his chest. And the one trainer that's still showing up there is on the roof screaming at the referee.
Yeah, I thought I would have think you know would think the fighter in that situation would be the most upset, but
yeah, right.
Be that set up, been out of shape about it. You know, if you're ready to go, and you tell the guy, "Hey, I'm ready to go," and then he waits off the fight, I would be freaking out if I was the fighter. But sometimes guys react differently in those situations, and maybe he was a little bit stunned. You never know. Anyway, in other results, we had Billy Joe Saunders, 18-0 with 10 knockouts. Got a one-sided 12-round unanimous decision over Gary O'Sullivan, who is 16-1 with 10 KOs. And unbeaten super middleweight Frank Buglioni, 9-0 with 6 KOs, outpointed Kirill Posonko, who was 10-26 on that card. So, talked a little bit earlier about Ronda Rousey, and there's a pretty interesting article that was in Yahoo Sports about Julie Kedzie, and obviously Tom and I watched that documentary. We saw her in the Jackson's MMA camp, and she's only got two strike force losses to Miesha Tate and Alexis Davis. And she's basically, she's one of the UFC's fighters now. She's been fighting for over 10 years. And this article basically says that, you know, Rousey and Tate and all these female fighters owe it all to Julie Kedzie for trailblazing the path. The women's MMA when she fought Gina Carano on one of those Strikeforce events. Or actually, it was I think it was Elite XC at that time. So, getting back to the beginning. And she's had a pretty impressive career, and definitely would like to see her make the most of it in the UFC. Working with Jackson's MMA, I'm sure that it will probably happen soon. She keeps up her good pace there. All right, now here's the... We got these stories out of order here. Here's the five-fight deal. Yeah, it was a five-fight deal. Chael Sonnen signed with the UFC. August 17th is the first one. And his direct quote from Sonnen: "After I get done with Shogun, I'm returning to middleweight. There's two guys that I want to get matched up with. First is Vitor Belfort because he's awesome and on an incredible roll. Second is Wanderlei Silva, who I've now found out is going back to middleweight. The landscape has completely changed. I got a new contract, and I'm returning to the weight class." So this is only his second fight at 205 since losing to Anderson Silva, and I'll go right back down to middleweight. Big news this week, Chuck Liddell. I know when we talked about fighter pay, I don't think Tom was available for that show. But fighter pay was a big issue a couple weeks ago. And Chucky came out of the woodwork and said, "Hey, listen, you know, I fought for like $6,000 a fight max back in the day. So that was with all the bonuses and everything. So shut up." Now Chuck is saying, kind of a lot like Dana White. I think these two guys are hanging around a little bit too much together. But he said, "The biggest problem in MMA today is fighters playing it safe." And he basically said the way that he went out on the Shield is the way all guys should fight. He said, "I'm probably not going to be popular with the fighters on this one, but my biggest problem is guys playing it safe. I understand it from the coach's standpoint and the manager's standpoint. I understand why you'd want to play it safe and win every fight. I get it. But do I want to watch a guy go beat a guy for four rounds and then ride him the fifth round not doing anything? You want to be worth more? Go out and fight. Have fun. Knock people out. Submit them. Beat them. Just go try and finish a fight." Interesting.
You know, on the fighters' pay topic, I just caught, I was out west then, and I caught a little bit of a few of the comments on the Underground. And the general feeling was it's kind of making a mockery out of MMA. The sport's just losing legitimacy if these guys are forced to fight for, you know, almost like, hey, well, would you like fries with that? And then you compare that to other sports, and, you know, Dana likes to say, well, this is the fastest growing sport in the world, but look at the pay scale. I mean, I had no idea that Weidman made what he made. I had to keep staring at the screen there for a minute and say, am I really seeing this? So that was kind of a lot of the, you know, I wish I'd been on for that show because I'm sure you had some comments on that one too. But that was the general feel that I got, that it was really starting to become an issue, not just with the fighters, but with public perception. Well, if those guys were worth anything, they'd be making a lot more. And it's kind of hard to counter that.
Well, the big thing is with the revenue streams that the UFC has, you'd think mm-hmm. they wouldn't make such a big deal out of it. So I was saying, well, if it's not that much of a problem to you, Dana White and the Fertittas, then, you know, why do you have such a problem putting all the numbers out there? You know, why is mm-hmm. it always a secret what you pay for locker room bonuses and all that kind of stuff? You always flap that out there like, oh, well, hey, we give these guys bonuses. Well, why don't you publicize that so people stop complaining? Or why don't you put all your figures out there so, you know, if you have a legitimate argument that you can't pay people more, then tell us why. You know, why did you guys get all that money? Why do you need it for all the background stuff? I mean, show us your expenses, basically, if you're going to try to make an argument that these guys aren't justified to earn that much unless they perform. And if it's going to be a performance-based thing, there's ways to do that, too. I mean, one of my ideas, not really performance-based, but, you know, the biggest beef that made the most sense to me was John Cholish talking about how he had to bring everybody and their brother down to Brazil for his fight. And he's only getting paid $8,000. And he's got to fly people in himself. And then, you know, when you don't get the win bonus on top of that, you're basically paying out of your own pocket to go to this fight. And
and it works the other way too with the fighters, like we talked about this, the fighters coming from Asia or coming
right.
from Brazil or Europe over here, because you can't just arrive the day of the fight. And so
and
you're looking at least
like,
if they paid a
certain bonus before the fight for travel to people that had to go over a certain distance, that would take care of all that guy's whole complaint. He would have no legs to stand on.
Right.
You know, the other thing they could do, actually, that was kind of the same thing that Lorenzo Fertitta mentioned as a fix before Dana White came out and said there'd be no changes to the bonus system. Lorenzo came out and said, why don't we give a finishing bonus? You know, forget knockout of the night and that sort of thing. You know, that still happens, but we'll just give you a win bonus, a win pay, and a finishing bonus just to finish a fight, which makes a lot of sense. And you'd think if they want these guys to you know, go out there and perform to the best of their ability and stop fights and take it out of the hands of the judges, then that would be a no-brainer for them to do. But Dana White,
exactly, yeah. And it still gets back on that 800-pound gorilla in the back of the room there as far as the entire legitimacy of MMA. It's like, well, why are the best athletes going into that sport considering the compensation and the pay structure? So that's to me that really resonated. I mean, I understand the struggle of the fighters, but just as an even bigger issue here, just the general perception, where, you know, this has got to be some oddball, you know, non-mainstream activity because there's no one's making any money at it except the top few guys, and even the top guys compared to the top boxers or let alone the NFL or the NBA.
Yeah, and I my idea was not necessarily a finishing bonus. I think it's for the main card usually, and sometimes the preliminary guy will get one, but typically it's the televised fights, and maybe they should just set up a bonus the preliminary, strictly the preliminary guys. Maybe half the bonus of the main fights, you know, whatever they get, but just for the preliminary guys, because people do watch them. I mean, they tune in on Twitter and FX and all that for the preliminaries for a lot of these fights. So, fights, you know, starting from the very beginning of the event. But the bottom line is base increase, because that's what's getting reported. And if it's getting reported that you're paying guys, you know, less than $10,000 for a 15-round fight, and, you know, that's in their contract, every fight, that's what they're making. How do you expect them to want to stick around to do better to get to the top pay? Can't even afford it, you know, because they're training expenses. That's a lot to ask a guy. And, you know, it was one thing when the sport was new and these guys were just basically fighting to establish the sport, but now it's established and they're still doing it. And they talk about, well, you know, you want to make Anderson Silva money, then go out there and fight like Anderson Silva. Well, how do you even get to Anderson Silva's level if you're a prospect and you can't justify the expenses to what it takes to actually get ready to get to that point? And, you know, these people that he's paying $6 to $8 to maybe $10 grand the fight. His base pay, his show pay, that's basically it. And as we know, anything can happen in a fight. So my perspective on it is, you know, they just have to increase that base pay or at least explain to us why they can't, instead of just calling idiots for questioning it. You know? And I think it is pretty comparable to boxing, you know, depending on which card it is. But The big gap is with the superstars in boxing and the superstars in MMA. The guys in MMA that are making all the money, they're making it mostly on sponsorships. They're not making it from the UFC and their base pay and their bonuses and all that. Yeah, the UFC's made some millionaires, but you know, you're never going to see anybody make $1 million as a base pay for a fight in the UFC. Not for a long time anyway, but right now, I don't think you see it. I think the biggest I've ever seen is $600,000. That was Anderson Silva's last fight. So, I don't know if we're ever going to see $1 million payday for a guy. And then that's where complaints aren't coming. For the most part, hey, you know, you got to pay the top guys in MMA more. Because I think they're in this box. Just for everybody. I think the UFC actually sponsored him for one of his fights, which was kind of weird. Anyway, so Chuck Liddell came out. Go ahead.
You know what's funny? You ever see the movie came out about a year ago? Here Comes the Boom with Kevin James.
I did not see it, but it was filmed in my old high school, believe it or not.
Really?
Quincy, Mass. Quincy High School. Can't hear you, Tony. Speak into the mic.
Kevin Jones is a biology teacher. You know, he works, you know, at this school, and Henry Wing was a teacher, and he's going to have him and his wife's going to have another baby, and then they're going to get rid of the music program, which is going to cost Henry Winkler's job. He was over his buddy's house that he tutors on, like, passing his American citizenship. This guy's, like, Brazilian or whatever, so he's trying to teach. So they go over to watch UFC fights, and the fight they showed was, I forget the guy, but he's fighting Brian Stan. And he beat Stan with a shoulder lock. And it was, like in, like, the first round. And they're like, man, and Stan got $10,000 for that. He got $10,000 to lose? And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, now granted that was a preliminary fight on whatever card that was. Still, for a fight that was generating that much in pay-per-view, $10,000 really, I hate to say it, is not a whole hell of a lot.
Exactly.
And I'm going to go, I mean, now let's change the dynamics of inflation a little bit. And you figure in 1998, that's 25 years ago, a quarter of a century ago, Mike Tyson made $22 million to fight Michael Spinks, and that went 91 seconds. I don't remember how much Spinks made for that fight, but I'll tell you right now, it wasn't $10,000. Now, you take this fight coming up next month with, in about a month or so, with Mayweather and Canelo Alvarez. And Mayweather, he's going to make, I mean, I don't know his reported price. I heard someone say like $80 million. I don't know if that's correct or not. I can't see how it is, but at the same time, it is Floyd Mayweather. But Canelo's going to make eight figures for that. Eight figures. That's the main event fight. Do you see any UFC fighter out there making eight figures? No, not at all. Not even close. I mean, do any of them, how much do they, for a big UFC fight, and I'll say, the one that we had a few weeks ago, Anderson Silva, where he lost. How much did they make for that fight?
Silva made $600,000.
Okay, but how much did Weidman make, the winner of the fight? Remember what he made?
Weidman
Chris
made
Weidman.
$48,000, not including a knockout for the night bonus.
Right.
How much did he make?
$50,000. So he made under $100,000, basically.
$1,000.
Which of them?
Your main event fighter. Right there. Favorite fighter. Viewers. Made $100,000. And the underdog fighter that ended up winning the fight made $48,000.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tony, here's one for you. What is the minimum wage? In the pro boxing rank.
And also, even if it's 30 million, 10 million. Mm-hmm. No,
okay,
the undercard fighters. We got Danny Garcia on there.
Okay. Excuse me a second. I got this on my mind. What is the current minimum wage for pro boxers per round? Or is it like, I know it used to be like $100 per round was the minimum, I thought. But what is it now? Do you know offhand?
Tony, you there?
Unfortunately, that whole part broke up. I did not hear a thing about that.
He wants to know what the minimum per round the boxers get paid.
It depends. You take a small, local, non-televised card. Say I go to a card in Philadelphia. They'll average, say, $100 to $200 a round.
Oh, okay.
So if a guy's going to fight, say, a 10-round fight, he might get, $1,500 to $2,000. Now, some of it's obviously got to go to his manager, his trainers, and all that. Big money doesn't really come in until you start getting television money, ESPN money. Back in the day, USA Tuesday Night Fights money. That's why a lot of guys I know from Philly, even if they weren't on the televised part of the card, used to love to fight at the Blue Horizon when it was on USA. Because instead of saying it'd be $30,000, or $20,000 that's got to be divvied up between these so many fighters, there's, $100,000. So the amount of revenue just went up five times the amount. Now, I'm just throwing those numbers out there as an example. But you go back and you look, as I was saying, with these small cards, local cards, these guys are making comparable money to some of these guys on a UFC pay-per-view card. And I'm not talking about the main event. I'm talking about, some of the guys that are not even going to be seen. When there's a boxing pay-per-view card, there's usually three to four televised bouts. Like, say, three undercard fights in the main event. Those fighters are all making a nice little chunk of change. But there's usually about four fights that are non-televised. those fighters are also, even some of them were like early in their careers or pro debuts, they just happen to be on a Mayweather card. They're getting, you know, what, and I'm not going to say Mayweather money isn't, they're not getting obviously the same amount, but they are getting like an incentive because they're fighting on the same card as Floyd Mayweather. And that's what, like, that extra revenue is kicking in. So you take a fighter, let's say, my friend Harry Yorgi, he just fought a 10-round fight at the Valley Forge Casino last month. Tom and I went, so it was a good fight. I'll say for that fight, now I can't, and I don't know this for sure. I haven't talked to Harry since the fight, and I would never ask him the same way because it's not my business. But I'll say for that fight, Harry probably made a couple grand. You know, he probably made, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, maybe $6,000 or $7,000. I don't know. I can't say that for sure. But he made a couple grand. But that was a non-televised card. You know, it was locally televised. It wasn't USA, it wasn't ESPN, it wasn't HBO. It was like on like a CN8 in Philadelphia, which is a local, like, news network. But for the most part, that was a non-televised card. Harry Yorgi probably made the same amount that an undercard fighter on a UFC card made. He probably made more than a guy fighting on a pay-per-view UFC card. And that's what's wrong with UFC. You guys got me all fired up again.
Yeah, well, it's different. You know, boxing is very dependent on what kind of crowd, what kind of pay-per-view numbers are coming in for the pay. But one thing about boxing is they typically reveal all the numbers. You know, we always find out how many pay-per-views were sold. We always, and the UFC doesn't always report that stuff. So they do give pay-per-view bonuses to fighters, though. I know the main event guys always get pay-per-view bonuses for whatever they sell. But it always comes down in the debate to what the bottom guys are getting and whether that's enough. And I look at it like, well, you know, if a guy never gets up to main event card status and he fights his whole career in the preliminaries, how's he ever going to retire? I don't know if there's many people that do that, but the UFC has a lot of fighters on their roster. I just had to look at it for a story the other day, and just the welterweights alone, there's 77 fighters on the roster. And a lot of those guys are names that I really have never seen on a main event card. So it makes you wonder, you know, like, how long are these guys going to stick around? And, you know, if they do, and they're never that talented where they're going to get a title shot or a main event slot, how are they going to retire with their earnings? They're probably not. They're probably going to have to do something else. But it's just one of those things where it's a debate that people keep bringing up, and the UFC keeps shutting people down without explaining why they can't put their money where their mouth is, basically, and start spreading the love a little more. You know they can afford it. That's the thing. Like, you know, so why make a big deal out of it? If you can afford to do it and it's no sweat off your back, why act like, you know, people are trying to pull teeth out of your head? Say something to appease everybody and let it rest. But I think they just can't stress enough that they want people to perform better, which is a whole other aspect of the debate that I think I brought up before. You know, maybe you should be encouraging these guys for their own health to fight like that. Fight like Chuck Liddell is saying, without playing it safe at all, to just go out there and beat people down and put yourself at risk every single fight. You know, that seems to be the mentality that they're stressing, that you have to put on a show. And I actually wrote an article years ago when I first started this bonus thing, where I suggested that the bonus system could be dangerous.
Absolutely.
It could be encouraging guys to take more risks in fights, and it's already a dangerous sport, so why would you add that incentive to it to make it more dangerous? And maybe submissions aren't that dangerous. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with a submission bonus. You know, if the ref is smart enough to stop it right when the guy taps, or the guy is smart enough to tap before he gets to the point where he passes out, then submissions I don't think are as dangerous. But knockout bonuses, it's kind of a weird line. You know, maybe you don't want to cross. Probably shouldn't be giving them. But I don't know. The jury's still out on that because there hasn't been a definitive test of all these guys. I know they're working on one down in Las Vegas right now, of all fighters, not just MMA, but boxers too. But we have to look at the health risks. I mean, this is a dangerous sport all around. And if you're going to encourage guys to make it more dangerous for money, I think you're walking a bad line. But
the fans want action.
Right, yeah. But if you are going to do it, you know, then you got to make it fair for everybody, not just the top guys, not just the main.
Right.
You got to have bonuses for the younger guys, too, on the preliminary.
Yeah,
card.
Exactly, because I think it gets to a point where it's not that they wouldn't want to stay around, but they can't stay around. They can't afford it. And with some of these guys, you know, some of these old-timers are complaining, well, you know, I fought for $1,000 back then. Well, yeah, it was 20 years ago. And this is a whole other world now.
Right. And the other thing is, you know, why not waive the bonus or the threshold payment that these sponsors have to come in and pay the UFC just to put their logo on somebody? You know, for these younger guys that aren't getting paid a lot for the fight, why not just say, all right, well, you can go out there and get a sponsor. We won't charge your sponsor an arm and a leg just to sponsor you. You know, we'll just let you have all the money, or we'll reduce it for the guys that aren't on main events.
Do you have an idea how much that sponsorship fee is?
Well, I heard it's as low as $50,000 for some fighters. Like, I think the only time I ever got a figure on that was when I met what's his name, Johnny Doomsday Howard. He was in a show up in, actually it was an event up in Boston for one of his sponsors, which was Bare Bones Fight Gear or something like that. And one of those guys told me, the owners of the company told me that he was looking for a way around that. And I had heard that there was a way around it. Some people were able to sponsor different fighters without paying that. But actually, beyond the guy's shorts, you automatically have to pay at least $50,000 to the UFC just before you even pay the fighter anything to be on his shorts. But that was 4 or 5 years ago now, so it's probably gone up since then. And then to sponsor the UFC itself, it's millions of dollars. So that's some money they should be throwing at the fighters instead of just, you know, pocketing it. But it is what it is. Hopefully they'll take a look at it and they'll do something about it. But I just don't understand why they have to just call everybody an idiot or a moron who questions the system and not explain why they can't do it. You know, just it doesn't help their argument, doesn't make them look like professionals. And for the most part, I mean, it just doesn't make sense for you to call somebody that's a Cornell graduate like John Cholish a moron. You know, the guy's obviously not a moron because he can leave the UFC and be a stockbroker and probably make more money doing that. So he's not stupid. He can obviously sustain himself doing something that's not going to put him at risk. A guy that's been beat up so much that's all he can do, you can call him a moron all you want, you know. If that's what he chooses to do and he's not good at it and he keeps getting beat up, then maybe he is a moron. But a guy that backs out because he's more successful in the private sector, but they might as well call Brian Stan a moron, too. You know, even though he didn't complain about his pay, he's doing the same thing. He's leaving to go cover football. So I just don't think it helps their cause at all, and it just shows their insensitivity to the fighters, at least Dana White's insensitivity. I know that Lorenzo is a little bit of a different story. I mean, he has the money to burn. I've seen pictures of some of his houses, so I know he has the money. He doesn't need the money that bad. So I just think that they would be better served to take a look at the whole pay structure and decide once and for all, hey, you know, maybe we should set the standard here. And the other thing is, it's gotten to the point where, you know, every time somebody mentions it, they don't even bother to look at the other organizations and compare. It's just bottom line. We know the UFC makes the most money, and they make a lot of it, and they should pay these guys. We don't even need to look at what other organizations are paying. We just know that these guys are at the top of the game. They're at the top dog MMA league, and they ought to be paying the standard. And what that standard should be across the board, I don't know. But, you know, definitely for guys that are, you know, trying to fight for these top spots, they definitely need to get a little bit more than what they're getting, I think. Well, we could talk about it all day. Here's a story. Canelo Alvarez and Sergio Martinez are going to be included in a review to be published in Art of Boxing magazine. I don't know if you're familiar with this one, Tony, but Art of Boxing magazine. And it's basically, it's kind of a weird setup, but they take a 10-point system that marks a complete boxer. And they analyze different boxers with that, and they put it into a magazine. And this 10-point strategic boxing system was put together by the founder of the magazine, Vinny Furlani. And he actually had some input on this from Floyd Patterson. So Tracy Harris Patterson, which it doesn't say here in the article whether he's the direct son or grandson or whatever, but it's obviously directly related, is going to work with Vinny Furlani on July 25th and 26th, tonight and tomorrow, actually, to record several boxing training videos in addition to this profile of Martinez and Alvarez. The series will be entitled Training Like a Champ, and it's going to include several essential methods in this strategic boxing system. And they're supposed to be completed, all these tapes will be completed by September 1st. And they'll be up for sale at artofboxingmag.com. And Patterson said, as a professional boxer, I know boxing demands more from a fighter than just natural talent and physical strength. It's only when effective techniques play a major role in a combination that you see real winners make history. Having learned the ultimate old-school boxing techniques from my father and master, Floyd Patterson, there you go, that's his father, we are eager to demonstrate in video each step of the system, preparing aspiring talents to become real champions. And Vinny uncovers each individual step of the 10-point strategic boxing system in every issue of Art of Boxing magazine. In a section titled Vinny's Corner, this month, point four, the hook to the body, which will be introduced. Vinny admits this was the point that propelled him to create the boxing system, which, when executed in proper form, gives the fighter the best chance of succeeding. So anyway, there's a lot more details on what the rest of the magazine will include, but Alvarez and Martinez will be two of the five fighters selected by boxing expert and magazine founder Vinny Furlani to be included in the review detailing each of their boxing techniques. And as the premier source for boxing fans and fighters, according to the story anyway, the publication will be featuring an examination in their upcoming issue to be released July 31st. And the anticipated assessment will detail how professional middleweight boxers Canelo Alvarez, Sergio Martinez, Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., Andre Ward, and Marco Antonio Rubio perform in relation to the 10-point strategic boxing system. And it's developed by Furlani and former Olympic gold medalist and two-time world heavyweight champion Floyd Patterson. So you may want to check out artofboxingmag.com, Tony.
So I'll check that out. That's really interesting, actually. You know how much of a fan I am, you know.
All right.
Anything interesting like that, you know, I'm holding in for it.
Well, we have Floyd Mayweather, obviously. He's been in the news a lot lately. He's got this fight coming up with Canelo. And I don't know if I have it right in front of me, but he did an interview recently. I got some Floyd Mayweather slamming news. Somebody slammed him from the UFC. Not a fighter, but somebody else. We'll get to that. But before that, I did want to mention I saw an interview with him where he talked about the possibility of still fighting Manny Pacquiao. He's open to it, believe it or not. Only under one condition, though. It has to be under Mayweather Promotions. So Pacquiao would have to quit Bob Arum and come over and sign with Mayweather Promotions. So, in other words, no way.
To add to this, I did see a letter in the Ring magazine I got the other day that one fan was still calling for it. He goes, you know what, he goes, just because Manny lost the fight, well, actually, he lost two fights, even though he really didn't lose the Timothy Bradley fight. He did lose his last fight rather convincingly. I think there's still, a want and a desire to see this fight. So that was still from the fans' perspective. I did see somewhere recently, might have been on Twitter or might have been on Facebook, that Pacquiao has now said he would go through with the drug testing.
Well, yeah, he had said that years ago, but the problem, the latest problem, is not with drug testing, it was with the split. I think Mayweather told him flat out, I want to give you a flat rate of $40 million, and that way I get the proceeds of the pay-per-view. And Pacquiao just basically hung up the phone on that deal. So the thing was, he wanted 50-50. And now because he's lost a couple of fights, he'd probably be willing to take less than 50-50, but now Mayweather, I think, just wants to make it impossible, and he's got a personal thing with Bob Arum more than Manny, because he used to be with Bob Arum and now he's not. So he even mentioned that in the interview, and he said that that's the only way it's going to happen. Now he's going to have to sign with Mayweather Promotions, and he also mentioned that he might fight beyond 49 fights, but in the interview he said he was just joking about that. But we'll see. He's happy being 49-0, apparently. He wants to match Marciano. If he can get there, we don't know. We'll see. But anyway, Joe Rogan made the news recently because he reminded Mayweather that even though he's boxing's pound-for-pound king, he wouldn't have a chance in hell against even the lower-tier fighters in MMA. And he took it a step further, saying that Mayweather didn't even have what it takes to hold his own against an average collegiate wrestler. And he said Floyd Mayweather would get killed by an average college wrestler. There would be no competition. If you took Floyd Mayweather today and made him fight against your average college wrestler, the college wrestler is going to shoot on him, pick him up, drop him on his head, and knock him out. There's nothing that Floyd can do about it. He's going to get knocked out by getting slammed on his head. A judo guy would do the same thing to him. A jiu-jitsu guy would strangle him, no question about it. I don't know who suggested that he would be able to hack it against. That's kind of
how many times have the three of us said it, and we've had guests that have said it. You take your best boxer, your Floyd Mayweather, you put him in an octagon, he is at a severe disadvantage. The only fighters that I could have seen that could have been possibly competitive in an octagon environment are fighters that are strictly, offensive strikers. Like a prime Mike Tyson would have been adequate. I'm not saying he would have been good. He would have been adequate because his hands were so fast and he could knock you out with one punch. A defensive fighter like Mayweather would not be good. We saw what happened when James Toney tried it, and I called that one. I said, James Toney's going to lose this fight almost immediately. If he's a guy that likes to fight off the ropes, let the guy crowd him and then counter him on the inside. And I said, and James doesn't have a high work rate. And he let Randy Couture get close, Couture took him to the ground and tapped him out.
400 grand, too. by the way.
Yeah. What?
He made $400,000 for that too. Tony.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That ain't bad. But like you're the guys that would have done the best would have been guys that, you know, I think Roy Jones would have actually been really good once again because he was fast, he had a good defense, he hit hard, and he could move fast, so it wouldn't be as easy to take him down. Those are the guys that I think would have had a fighting chance out there. But most of your guys, you know, a boxer in that environment is not going to fare well. But you take a, you know, you take what happened to Anderson Silva a couple weeks ago, that would have been a common occurrence in a boxing ring because of his mistake. He's a guy that likes to move around. Now, I'm not talking about a showboat, but he likes to often go with his head up in the air, his hands down, and that's a recipe for disaster in the sport of boxing.
Right. Yeah, I don't know what brought this on, how this came out in discussion, but I guess Rogan just had to put it out there.
Yeah, and it really spun out of control on the underground. There was a guy that just got his blue belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and he was talking all this trash. And I mean, fine in theory, but when you're closing the distance on a superb athlete like Floyd Mayweather, I mean, these punches are going to be coming at you 95 miles an hour, and you better be ready. I mean, it's just this whole thing just started to get out of control. I had to stop reading it after a while.
Well, one boxer who has a great shot at making a transition to MMA is another woman from the documentary we just talked about last week with Landon Dysterhouse, and that's Holly Holm. She had a fight. I didn't even know it was on. I didn't see it, but I saw a site that had the GIF image, the animated final kick of the shot she landed against Alana Jones, who just happens to be one of the opponents of the she-male, I guess, the transgender fighter, Fallon Fox. But Alana lost another fight here to Holly Holm, and Holly knocked her out with a vicious head kick. Just totally dropped her to the ground, and just perfectly placed, too. She's not only a boxer, but she's got kickboxing experience. So I would think, like, old Duke Rufus out there in Milwaukee, who has his own camp, kickboxing would translate a lot better to MMA than just regular boxing. And Holly is one of those people that you would expect. If she can get the ground game down, which, you know, at Jackson's probably the perfect place to do it, she would definitely give any woman fighter at the top of the game a run for her money. Just give her a couple of years in the fight game. She signed, I think, a few fights with Legacy FC. She's not very big. And she has fought on Bellator, so that kind of made me wonder why she didn't go with them. Maybe she doesn't want to travel so much. But I think Legacy does a lot of fights in her home territory. So I think she's just going to, you know, kind of tune herself up on the local circuit, and then hopefully the UFC will come calling. And they're going to really test her mettle against some ladies that can roll on the ground and do everything. But I don't think anybody's going to want to strike with her once she gets to that point where, you know, she can keep it on the feet and she has the good takedown defense and all that, and she can keep the fight where she wants it. So I'm looking forward to what happens.
And I have to keep going back to Marcus Davis, because you remember when he first got into the MMA with his boxing background, he figured, well, I'll just deal with these guys with my hands. And then it was, well, I'll just learn a little Muay Thai, or I'll learn a little takedown defense. And finally, he just said, hey, I've just got to change everything around. And he got pretty good on the ground, and then his stand-up game won quite a few fights for him when he wasn't worried about being taken down.
So, well, I know we have to preview UFC on Fox 8, but I couldn't resist this next story. We don't talk enough about wrestling. So this has kind of been brewing for a while, but apparently there's some guy out there who's got all the results of every WWE fight before it happens. comedy. So a list of scripts out there, and he's correctly predicted the last 38 WWE matches.
Wow.
And so now they're looking for him. They want to know who he is, whether he's an insider, whether he just has inside information.
About that. I did see something about that. So it was like,
get on news. It's not a major news station. Surprise.
Yeah. Maybe it's a real thing that I saw. And they're like, oh, this guy, you know, the second coming Eric Bischoff, because back in the day, that's what he used to do, was give away the results.
Yeah.
He was a competitor in WCW, and WWE used to, at the time, WWF. They would tape their Monday night shows. They would do one on Monday, and then they would have one on Tuesday, and they would tape it for the following week. So the following week, he'd be like, you know what, you might not want to tune into that this week because, you know, it's tape. I'll tell you who won. And he's like, yeah, Undertaker beat so-and-so, and this person beat so-and-so, and what's happened here. And then but ended up, you know what, he ended up losing the war anyway.
Right. Well, basically, the guy's nickname on Reddit is Dolphin1925. And he's ironically commenting that the reason he's doing this is an attempt to get WWE to stop leaking who will win. And he says, this is a direct quote of it. I am just a WWE fan, and I am getting my information from a source who has very credible inside information. We both feel that I should continue to share this information until it garners the attention of WWE. These people whom are leaking this information are profiting off it at the expense of WWE, the fans, and the integrity of the product. I'm hoping you can put an end to WWE insiders leaking pay-per-view outcomes. And WWE has actually made light of it. And they said, we may have a modern-day Nostradamus on our hands. We might have to monitor these posts in advance of our next pay-per-view to see how good he or she really is. This is the worst part of this whole thing. Because this story came out, I found out that people actually bet on WWE. Can you believe it?
Oh, God.
They actually bet on it. So that just blew my mind. Why would you bet on something fake? That's like betting on the outcome of a fucking soap opera. No.
Is he going
to get with him or is he going to get with her? Whacked. But it does happen. And bets are actually capped at low limits precisely because something like this could occur, according to Yahoo. Anyway. So it is what it is. Somebody's out there. If you want to find out what happens in the next WWE and mess with your friends who are watching with you, do a Google search for Dolphin1925, all one word. So, getting back to real news. UFC on Fox 8 coming up Saturday. Big main event is Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson fighting John Moraga. And all I know from Johnson's fight is he's got an incredibly well-rounded style, and it's hard to even score points against this guy. I liked the way John Dodson came at him in the first couple rounds, but he just couldn't sustain it to win that fight there. But Moraga, I really don't know anything about. He's 13-1. I don't even think I've seen him fight. If I have, I forgot about it. So that doesn't bode well for him.
I think we're going to have a decision for Mighty Mouse in that one. So
probably.
That's my call there. And I don't think it'll be a barn burner.
Right. He's actually probably the most underappreciated champion in all of UFC because he just doesn't have exciting fights. It's just
right.
His style. It's not very exciting. But
well, Marengo was saying, you know, his fights are so predictable that, you know, you can go to the kitchen, get a sandwich, get a beer, come back, and everything's just the way it was. And now Marengo obviously feels he's got the he has the ability to make it different this time, but I don't see it.
And probably the better fight on this card is the co-main event. We got Rory McDonald, who's 14-1, fighting Jake Ellenberger. Ellenberger, I don't know how long ago he fought. Let me just check it. I'm not sure, dog, right now, but I think he's been out for a while, if I remember correctly. But he's, McDonald is 14-1. Ellenberger is 29-6. Obviously, he got a lot of experience over McDonald. But let's just check. When's the last time Ellenberger fought? Fought Nate Marquardt back in March on UFC 158. So it actually wasn't that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a first-round knockout at the end of the first round, I guess.
Well, if I have to go out on a limb and if I have to pick for pick one underdog for the whole show, I'll go with Jake. You heard it here first.
All right.
All right.
The psychic has spoken. Then we got another guy who's been all over the fight game, Robbie Lawler. He's got 20 wins, 9 losses, fighting Bobby Volker, 24-9. As the Coco main event, I guess you could say. And by the way, Rory McDonald, he's only got one loss. Trying to figure out who that loss was against there for a second. That was Carlos Condit at UFC 115 back in 2010. He's on a 4-fight win streak, beating Nate Diaz, Mike Pyle, Shea Mills, and BJ Penn in his last fight. Back on December 8th of last year. So he hasn't fought in a while, actually. Almost 7 months on the shelf there. Actually, more than 7 months. So we'll see how that goes.
I think Robbie Lawler, maybe he's, it seems like he's been around forever. I don't think he's that old, but he seems like he is. But I have to go with him here. I think that he's just a step above technically and better opposition, a little better experience.
Well, their records are pretty similar. Bobby only has 4 more wins, same amount of losses. I don't think Volker has fought near the amount of big names, though, that Lawler has fought, especially in recent years. And one thing about Lawler is he's always exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's a good candidate to get a bonus on this fight card here. But Volker, his nickname is Vicious, but I don't know how vicious he really is. He's only got 2 knockouts. Oh, no, that's 2 knockout losses. Sorry. Only been knocked out twice. He has 15 of his 24 wins by knockout or TKO, 4 submissions, and 5 decisions. So he finishes the majority of his fights that he wins, anyway. He's gone to 6 losing decisions. He last fought March 16th on UFC 158, where he lost to Patrick Cote. And before that, he was in Strikeforce fighting Roger Bowling 3 times. I don't know why they would do that. But fought him last 2 times. He won by TKO. In the second round, first time he lost back in May of 2010 by unanimous decision. And I don't see any big names popping out at me on his whole entire record here, except his 1 UFC fight, which he lost to Patrick Cote. Nobody recognizable whatsoever. So I think, yeah, it's probably a good bet to say that Lawler is going to take this one pretty easily. Also have a big female fight, Liz Carmouche, 8-3, fighting Jessica Andrade, who's 9-2. I don't know much about Andrade, but obviously we saw Carmouche versus Rousey. She is actually the person who took Rousey the longest out of any other fight in her whole career. Took her the longest distance, so that says a lot about her. And Andrade's got 1 less loss, but that's a pretty comparable fight there. We'll have to see who does what in that one. Then we have tough winner, Michael Chiesa, the tough live season. He won the whole thing. He's 9-0 in professional MMA. He's fighting Jorge Masvidal, who's 24-7. And I've been seeing this lately with these guys. It seems like every other UFC fight, the matchmakers put them together pretty evenly. But lately with these tough guys, the way they did with Paulo Thiago and Kelvin Gastelum, guy's only 6-0, Gastelum, and they put him in with Paulo Thiago, and that fight was recently actually called off because of an injury to Thiago. But I thought that was weird, the way they just kind of throwing him to the wolves like that. You'd think they would give him kind of warm-up fights. But Chiesa, he's 9-0. I think he's had one other fight since the finale. Let me check his record. But Masvidal is way more experienced. We're talking 31 fights. That's three times more fights than Chiesa and more.
And he's very, very, very confident. He feels
he's
going to be like a gym workout, I guess. I mean, he said some very disparaging things about this.
And Chiesa, 25 years old. He's obviously pretty competent. He did pretty good on the Ultimate Fighter finale. He has only had one fight since that finale back in 2012, June of 2012, against Al Iaquinta. And that was a pretty quick win for him. That was a first-round win. Then he got a rear-naked choke on Anton Kuvanen at UFC 157 in February this year. And let me just take a quick peek at Kuvanen's record, but I don't think it's anywhere near Masvidal's experience. I would understand if the guy was like 24-20, but 24-7, I mean, that's tough. That's a big step up for a guy like Chiesa, who's just kind of getting his feet wet here in the organization. But maybe they see something in him that we don't know. Maybe he's just that good. We will see. But Kuvanen was 18-6, which is still a lot more experience, twice as many wins. But, you know, he hadn't really fought anybody with a big name either up to that fight. So we'll see. We'll see if he's really that good. But I think they're taking a little bit faster route than they normally would with a guy like that. So we'll see if it works out for Chiesa or Masvidal. Then we have Danny Castillo, 15-5, versus Tim Means. I know I've seen Castillo fight and probably seen a Means fight too, but I don't really know much about either guy. So, I don't know, Means has three more wins, one less loss. So I guess on paper he's probably the favorite, but I don't know technically and style-wise who would be favored in that one. Here's an interesting one, though. Melvin Guiard and Mac Danzig, a couple guys that have been around forever. They both have double-digit wins and losses. Guiard is 30-12-2. Danzig is 21-10-1. And they've both been around for a long time in the UFC. Big-time names who will probably never go away until they actually decide to, rather than getting thrown out of the organization. I know Guiard is taking a hiatus and come back from the, you know, been out to the UFC and then come back. But he's one of those guys that will always be around, I think, until he just doesn't want to do it anymore. Barring some absolutely disgusting display of, you know, no wind or something, or being out of shape, I think he'll retire in the UFC. So that should be a good fight. Then we have Eve Edwards, guy who's got the most fights of anybody on this card, I believe. He's 42-19-1. And I've actually seen him fight in Worcester. He's got a pretty good chin. He went three rounds with a tough local guy in that fight that I saw him in. He's fighting Darren Cruikshank, who's 12-3. So he's kind of, I guess, playing a little bit of a gatekeeper role in this one. See how good Cruikshank really is. And then speaking of Julie Kedzie, we talked about her earlier. She is fighting also on this card in the preliminaries. fighting a woman she should trounce. She only got a 3-2 record. Jermaine Di Randami. Kenzie 16-11. But she's got a heck of a lot of experience against the best in the business. So her fighting a 3-2 woman doesn't really make a lot of sense, but we'll see how it goes. Then we've got Big Red, Ed Herman, 20-9, fighting Trevor Smith, who's 10-3. Aaron Riley's back. He's 13-1, fighting Justin Salas, 10-4. And finally, John Albert, 7-4, fighting Yeltsin Meza, who's 19-8. So that's it. That's UFC on Fox 8. So free TV, and I don't know where they're going to do the prelims, whether it's going to be Facebook and FX or what, but usually that's the way they do it. So check that out as it happens. Other than that, I think that's just about it. I did find that Mayweather interview. Talking about Pacquiao. He says, don't get your hopes up. Well, actually, the article says, don't get your hopes up. He says, I wanted to fight Pacquiao at one particular time, but I wanted to fight him when he was at the top. This is probably written wrong, but it's written as, I'm not going to speak is what it should be, on another man's finance business. But like I said before, I left Top Rank for a reason. He's with Top Rank, so I want him to be happy with Top Rank. And he said he's been aware of some of the chatter among some fans still wanting to fight, but he made it seem very unlikely. And he says, everybody's like, oh, Pacquiao, but I'm just letting you know he's not getting a fight with me. The only way he's getting the fight with me is if he signs with Mayweather Promotions. He's got to give me fights with Mayweather Promotions. If he don't give me no fights under Mayweather Promotions, then he's not going to get the fight. That's how it's working right now. Because the ball is in my court. The ball has been in my court. I have been the A side. And here it is. I went to Pacquiao at one particular time, and I offered him $40 million, and I told him, I will wire you $20 million within 48 hours. He told me he wanted 50-50, and he got off the phone. And this is where the Pacquiao advisor, I don't know if Tom's been with the show since we've talked about this guy, but Michael Conks is Pacquiao's so-called advisor. And there was a couple of little news stories that kind of made me think, you know, this guy's a little weird. Apparently, he follows Pacquiao around just about everywhere and, like, sleeps on his floor. And he's just a weird guy. He's had some run-ins with physical fitness, I guess, strength and conditioning coach for Pacquiao. Had some big arguments. And nobody knows really what he does. He's just like, he's like a hanger-on, but he's gotten a real close relationship with Pacquiao. I mean, he goes to the Philippines with him and everything. And apparently Michael Conks got involved, and he came down to Mayweather's gym. Mayweather says, I don't know who he is. He looks like a little weasel. He came down here, he's in my gym, and he talked to me. He said, if you want the Pacquiao fight, you talk to me. I said, what about Top Rank? He said, I run all his business. That's what he told me. I got everything recorded, everything on film. So, very, very weird dude. And I think he ends up giving Pacquiao a bad rap because of, you know, associating with him. But it just doesn't make much sense why he would keep a guy like that around who would pull shady stuff like that. But Mayweather also talked about his impression of Alvarez after being on their cross-country tour for 10 days. He says, Canelo is a fan. For a kid who is just 23, he's a fan. He rolls the shoulder and he tries to box like me a little. Of course, I know he's a fan, but I can't take anything away from him. I can do nothing but respect him for that. If the tables were turned, I'd probably been a fan of Canelo's. And people saying that he could beat him, he says, don't they always say this is the guy? Don't they always say that? So, didn't really address that. An interesting topic about Al Haymon, who has a pretty big stable of fighters, and I guess there's a reason for that, because he really does care for his fighters. According to Floyd, he said, he's like a father figure to me. Why I love this guy so much is this. The whole time I sat down there at the Clark County Detention Center and done my time, he came. He stayed downtown near the jail, and he went to my lawyer's office every day the whole time I was in jail. I called him on the phone, and he said, I'm right here with you, Floyd, and I'm not leaving until you go home. So pretty interesting there. He's a stand-up guy. On putting together the Danny Garcia-Lucas Matisse fight on his undercard, said that's a very exciting matchup. Mayweather Promotions wants to give the people they want, people what they want to see, excitement. Of course, both fighters are Al Haymon fighters. How hard is it? Both fighters are under Golden Boy. We work hand-in-hand with Golden Boy, so how hard is it to make that fight? And it's actually been talked that the winner of that fight will get Floyd next. So that's not too uncommon for Floyd to do something like that either. I think that's pretty much what he did with Canelo's last undercard fight on his fight card. So we'll see how that goes. That might be the one that really could beat him if Canelo doesn't. And like I said about the hints that he made about fighting beyond the 49th fight, he said, I was just trash talking. I was having fun with the fans. I keep my fingers crossed, and I believe in my skills, and I believe in my talents. Hopefully I get to the 49-0 in my career, and I'll feel as if I had a great career. Everybody is trying to push me to that 50-0, but I'm okay with that 49-0. And last story I have is funny, but it's not funny. The best way to describe it. How would you guys feel about watching an amateur MMA fight between a guy with Down syndrome and a guy with cerebral palsy?
Yeah, you should. Funny, but not funny. Yeah.
Would you guys pay to see that? I don't know.
Nope.
It's happening. It's happening. It's actually sanctioned in Florida. Believe it or not, it's at a Seminole Indian casino in Immokalee, Florida, on August 3rd, 2013. Really happened. And it's Garrett Holub, who has Down syndrome. I think we've actually talked about this kid on the show before. His father was kind of against him getting into the sport, but he did it anyway. He's had some fights amateur, but they don't sanction it. They won't sanction him as a pro. And I think he's got, you know, pretty mild Down syndrome. He doesn't, he's got like kind of the facial features that you would expect, but he's got actually a pretty normal voice. It doesn't sound like he's that affected by the condition. And I don't know anything about his opponent here, David Steffen, but Steffen has cerebral palsy. And the way the bout got sanctioned is the king of the casino promoter, Mark Schopp, actually has an independent sanctioning body not affiliated with the Association of Boxing Commissions. And USA Today talked to Mitch Holev, who is Garrett's dad, and he says, Garrett understands and I understand that he's never going to become a professional fighter, so he's an amateur and he's followed the progression. I can't change being supportive of my son just because he's going into a contest where he's not being protected by the referee or his opponent. I don't know if there's going to be another opportunity for these guys to fight someone else again. The message that we try to send is that Garrett has taken this to the extreme, but martial arts has given him a lot. Their upcoming fight will be contested over 3 3-minute rounds under modified rules to include shin protectors and striking to the head being prohibited while the opponent is grounded anyway, not standing. Holev is a former Special Olympian and is known as G-Money inside the cage, and recently promised to hurt someone real bad. Hopefully it's not himself. So that's kind of a weird news of the week story. I've actually heard that boxing and MMA and combat sports in general are very therapeutic to people with different conditions. I recently actually saw bunch of stories about it, MMA especially, being very helpful to guys with PTSD coming back from war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan, places like that. So I guess it's therapeutic for these type of things too. More power to them, I guess. but I don't know if I'd pay to see it.
Yeah,
all right.
I agree.
Getting to that point where there's not much else here that I could bring up. You guys got anything you wanted to talk about? We didn't discuss anything coming up this weekend. I know there's another Friday Night Fights card. Boxing, I don't know about Saturday. I should know because I probably published a bunch of stuff on the blog. But... Tony, you got anything on boxing before we leave?
I'm going to leave it now. I don't even know what Saturday's date is.
The 27th. Well, while you're looking it up, I did want to mention this last story. Our former guest, Manisha Tate, is really taking to task another former guest, MMA referee Kim Winslow. And she's not being nice at all. She calls her horrible, says she's ruining lives. She made some really derogatory comments about the way she was talking to her during the fight, saying stuff like, you know, this lady has never fought in her life and she's basically coaching me. And her words were, like a little chihuahua barking. speaking of somebody who has a chihuahua in the house, that's very insulting. a barking chihuahua can be very annoying. So, horrible, she calls her. And said she's ruining people's lives and she shouldn't... She also mentioned that she shouldn't even be refereeing in the professional ranks. She should do amateur MMA or something. It all stems back to the Kat Zingano fight, where basically, I think we talked about this before, that Misha had a problem with it being stopped too early, but I don't think she ever went this far. And she said that after a few knees to the face, Kim stepped in and stopped the fight, but when Tate asked her why she stopped it, her answer obviously didn't satisfy her. She said something about, well, your face is a mess. Misha came back later on. I don't think she said it at the time. She said, your face is a mess, but they still let you referee. That wasn't nice. But she was more concerned that, you know, you shouldn't be stopping a fight because somebody is bleeding a lot. You should be, you know, basing it on their cognitive skills to keep fighting. So that was her biggest beef with the whole thing.
Well, that's the referee's judgment. And one of the responders on the threat on the Underground was saying that, yeah, he says, I agree. Maybe Kim just should let her... should let Kat just keep kneeing her until she was completely unconscious. So
right.
I was one of those judgment calls, and I know it's an ancient cliche, but you don't want to put the referee in that situation if you can help it. Easier said than done. But
yeah, she said she was like a yippie chihuahua the whole time that I was on the bottom. Misha, you got to do something. You got to move. I'm like, why? She's not doing anything to me. She's in my half guard. Nobody finishes fights in half guard. But the referee, I thought she was going to stop it. She was over-coaching, over-refereeing. It's something that is very frustrating when you have other people who have never fought a day in their life, like Kim. She doesn't do anything. I don't think she deserves to be a referee. And if she is, she should go into the amateur levels where it doesn't matter as much and there's not as much in the line because she's literally ruining people's lives.
Ruining people's lives. Wow. Okay.
But, you know, we've talked to Kim Winslow. We've had her on the show, and she seems like she's very well trained. She takes it seriously. I would think this is just loser's remorse here. And, you know, obviously we've talked to Misha, too, and we support her as a fighter. But, you know, this lady's just trying to do her job. You don't have to go off the hook on her like that and, you know, disrespect somebody just because they haven't fought a day in their life. I could understand if it's somebody like Dana White, who I always disrespect because he disrespects the fighters. But, you know, this is not a lady who goes out there and says bad things about people. So I think that's kind of classified by Misha to do that. And, you know, whether you agree with it or not, it's her judgment call, like you said, Tom. And they have a picture there of her face, and it is pretty badly messed up. She looks like she got a broken nose, blood all over the place, and her eyes don't look focused either. So
exactly. Well, you know, I hate these cliches, but they're so apropos that the time to complain about the referee and the officials is before you sign for the fight.
Right.
And it's that simple.
The only problem I've seen with Winslow not stopping a fight or being in any controversial situation was, I think, the last UFC event where she was assigned to a heavyweight fight and she had to pull some big lug off of, I think it was actually Gabriel Gonzaga.
Right, I remember that.
And Joe Rogan even said something like, why would they assign her to this fight? She's too small to pull that guy off of. So that's really the only major thing I've seen with it. They should probably put it in with the lower weight guys, if anything. But anyway, Tony, what do you got for us? Anything?
I've been a while for Saturday night. I believe it was on HBO. Down in San Antonio, Texas. We got a couple of decent little fights. Keith Longtime Thurman, interesting prospect. He's still undefeated. I'm pulling that up right now as we speak. He has these 20-18 knockouts, coming off a decision win back in March over Jan Zabak. He is fighting another undefeated fighter with nearly an identical record, Diego Gabriel Chavez. And he is 22-0 with 18 knockouts. So we got, looks like two power punchers. Somebody's O has got to go. WBA welterweight title. So that's a good main event right there. I can't say I know much about Chavez, but, you know, whenever you have two young undefeated fighters, that's not a bad thing, especially when you're putting them on prime time. And I think that I've seen Keith Thurman, he's been, you know, tried to end the night early. On the undercard, and of course, Box Check is now moving slow, we have Andre Berto and Jesus Soto Carras. So this is a fight that's pretty much set up for Berto to get himself back on track. Soto Carras is a good fighter, he's fast, he's got a good chin, but he's not especially fast, and he's easy to hit. So it's a fight. I don't know if, Soto Carras, he was stopped by Dave Rosado last year when I was down there. And like I said, I'm frozen right now, but I know he was stopped in a fight right after that. And I'm not remembering the fighters that did it. I apologize. But I don't know if Berto's going to take it out unless Soto Carras has really fallen, fallen pretty hard after that.
Yeah, actually, I was going to make a joke last week before when we were doing our show last week, but I totally forgot about it because I actually had a chance to talk to Jesus Soto Carras.
Okay, so we got Berto.
I didn't go
on. He was talking about over a year and a half after that loss to Robert Guerrero, so we don't know how rusty he'll be. He's 28-2, 22 knockouts. Soto Carras is 27-8, 3 draws, 17 knockouts to his credit. And he is coming off a win back in January. For the fight that I was talking about, he was stopped by Gabe Rosado January 2012, and then he was stopped by Marcos Maidana in a very, very exciting fight back in September. So those are the big matches on that card. We also got Andre Burrell's younger brother, Anthony, fighting a fighter by the name of Anthony Hanshaw, who's a pretty talented fighter. He took Rory Jones' distance a few years ago. When Jones was starting to fade a little bit, but still had a little bit left. So, we had a decent card. Top heavy, which is good. You know, we got a couple fights that should be should be friendly, should be fan friendly. So if you get a chance, tune into it on Saturday night.
All righty. So I think that's it. Do we know what's going on for Friday night fights this week?
Let me take a look at that. The problem is, this is where I started late again, and I'll probably, since I don't have a friend fighting, I'll probably fall asleep.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that, too, because I thought that was very weird. I kept switching channels and thinking, well, maybe it's not on. maybe it's blocked out in this area for some reason, because I'm in New Hampshire, and the fight was in.
Yeah.
But I was surprised they didn't show any of the other fights on there, too. I mean, there was some other...
No, they showed one fight with two undefeated fighters, and they were the one-punch knockout. Let me just run this main event for you real quick. It looks pretty interesting. Juan Carlos Burgos, 30-1, 20 knockouts. His only loss was a decision back about 3 years ago. He is fighting a fighter by the name of Yakubu Amadou, and I've heard the name. I'm sure I've seen him fight. I can't picture him right now. He's coming off two straight decision losses. Yeah. He fought Ji-Hoon Kim about a year and a half ago, and that was a pretty good fight. He's coming off two straight decision losses, but he's 20-4 with 18 knockouts. He's from Ghana, so that'll be a good fight for Burgos. So that's going to be a good, tough, exciting fight. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. And that was the main event on that show. And what were you about to say? Last week. Let me pull up the names real quick because they're escaping me. But it was a young undefeated fighter. I think it was a Rhode Island kid.
No, I think that was a kid from my hometown, where I went to high school, in Quincy. Brian Kielczewski. I did see the end of that.
Yeah.
But there was a couple of local guys from Brockton and Massachusetts that were also fighting that they didn't sit and put on there. I guess because the Kielczewski fight went a little long.
Yeah, that fight went five rounds, and he knocked Miguel Soto out. Kielczewski was 17-0. He was 16-0 with three knockouts coming into the fight. But Miguel Soto, who was 11-0 at the time, he's now 11-1. But he smoked him one devastating left hook right on the chin and good night, Irene.
Yeah. Pretty nice job there, but I don't think that kid was much of a challenge for him either. So I think they said something like his last few opponents were like 12-145. Definitely didn't have a very good record going into that one. So I'd like to see Ryan get tested next fight. But it was a good little opportunity for him to showcase his skills on Friday night fights anyway. So Friday night fights this week is the Thunder Valley Casino Resort in Sacramento, California. And you said Burgos versus Amadou in the main event. And we got Miguel Gonzalez versus Joe Senelson. I don't even know how to pronounce that name. Joe Senelson, Dos Santos. Gonzalez, 21-3, 15 KOs. 26-1 with 16 KOs. So that should be pretty good. James Toney will be there, too. I don't think he'll be getting paid that $400,000, though. And he won't be fighting. Actually, he is fighting. Toney is a 12-time world champion with a record of 75-8-3 and is still competing. And he's fighting Tony Lopez, who has got 50 wins, 8 losses, and one draw with 34 knockouts. So, interesting. I didn't know that he was still fighting. Boxing, anyway. I know they're still trying to get an MMA fight with Ken Shamrock, but that's crazy. All right, I guess that's it. The lady's trying to tell us to wrap it up, so until next week, adios.
All right, guys, we got a big weekend, and let's enjoy every fight we can see, huh?
All right.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks for stopping by, folks, and that's all she wrote. Bye.